Lucifer, Lilith, and the Serpent Girdle. George Sylvester Viereck was a German-American poet, writer, and propagandist. His father Louis, born out of wedlock to German actress Edwina Viereck, was reputed to be a son of Kaiser Wilhelm I. The Viereck family circle moved to the United States in 1896, when George was 12 years old. Viereck became known in the U.S. as a fantasy author and interview journalist. He wrote the first branded gay vampire novel and one of the first psychic vampire stories. In 1923, Viereck claimed that Hitler would transform the world. The Saturday Evening Post called Viereck the most widely discussed young literary man in the United States today. For his backing of Germany, Viereck was expelled from several social clubs and fraternal organizations. In August 1918, a lynch mob stormed Viereck's house in Mount Vernon, forcing him to seek refuge in a New York City hotel. In 1919, shortly after the Great War, he was expelled from the Poetry Society of America. Wikipedia.org. In early 1923, Viereck published, under the pseudonym George F. Corners, a popular science work advocating the youth restoration techniques of Austrian biologist Eugene Stinich. Freud was taken with the style, and suggested that Viereck publish a similar work on psychoanalysis. While no such work was ever written, Viereck did devote considerable effort, over the years, to preaching the gospel of psychoanalysis through interviews and articles. Sigmund Freud, Viereck Project. Sigmund Freud wrote to George Sylvester Viereck asking if he would report on the subject of psychoanalysis. Viereck traveled to Vienna to interview Freud, and then to Munich to interview Adolf Hitler. Viereck also interviewed other prominent people such as George Bernard Shaw, Benito Mussolini, Henry Ford, and Albert Einstein. He was personally associated with Aleister Crowley and became friends with the creative scientist and inventor Nikola Tesla. According to Tesla, Viereck was the greatest contemporary American poet. Tesla occasionally attended dinner parties held by Viereck and his wife. He dedicated his poem Fragments of Olympian Gossip to Viereck, a work in which Tesla ridiculed the scientific establishment of the day. Viereck founded two publications, The International and The Fatherland, which argued the German cause during World War I. Viereck became a well-known Nazi apologist. His interview with Adolf Hitler in 1923 had offered hints of what was to come. In 1933, Viereck again met with Hitler, now Germany's Führer, in Berlin, and in 1934, he gave a speech to 20,000 friends of the New Germany at New York's Madison Square Garden, in which he compared Hitler to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and told his audience to sympathize with National Socialism without being anti-Semites. His Jewish friends denounced him as George Swastika Viereck, but he continued to promote the German Nazis. Wikipedia.org. In 1941, George Sylvester Viereck was arrested in the U.S. for a breach of the Foreign Agents Registration Act when he set up his publishing house, Flanders Hall, in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. He was convicted in 1942 for his failure to register with the U.S. Department of State as a German Nazi agent. He was imprisoned from 1942 to 1947. Viereck died in 1962 at the age of 77, in Holyoke, Massachusetts. When the First World War began, the United States sought to continue commerce as a neutral power. But the belligerent powers wanted to seize war goods with sabotage and propaganda in America. William J. Flynn, then chief of the U.S. Secret Service, posted agents to maintain surveillance over the German embassy. In New York City, one prominent German under surveillance was George Sylvester Viereck, editor of a periodical called The Fatherland. Although no direct suspicions centered on Viereck, he was shadowed in the belief that persons active in espionage and propaganda might visit or associate with him, thus providing leads for further Secret Service investigation. Walter S. Bowen and Harry Edward Neal, The United States Secret Service, 1960. One of Viereck's contributing editors was Aleister Crowley, who from 1915 until 1917 wrote drivel for Viereck's pro-German periodicals, The Fatherland, and The International. Crowley later said that Viereck was homosexual at heart though, I believe not so in practice. Crowley most likely met Hugo Münsterberg, who he claimed was the director of German propaganda, through Viereck. At the outbreak of war, Aleister Crowley found himself caught up in conspiracy as his occult and espionage worlds became one. On July 24, 1915, Viereck was seen boarding a 6th Avenue train with another man who carried a slightly bulging brown leather briefcase. The man was Dr. Heinrich Friedrich Albert, Privy Councillor of the German government. While Dr. Albert read a newspaper, he forgot that he had placed the briefcase on a seat between his body and the window of the car. When the train stopped at the station where he wanted to get off, Albert by mistake stepped away from his seat for a short distance and Secret Service agent Frank Burke seized the briefcase. Dr. Albert was the highest financial agent of the Imperial German Empire in the United States. He had been spending millions of dollars every week to acquire sabotage and propaganda. His plans called for the purchase of American newspapers and magazines. He financed motion pictures with a pro-German slant and attempted to acquire aircraft patents to invade America and starve the metropolis into submission. Albert's briefcase held a gigantic plan for the military occupation of the United States. German soldiers were to land suddenly on the New Jersey coast and on Mexican shores, directed by the German Navy. Dr. Albert's chief accomplice was Captain Franz von Papen, the German military attaché who afterward became vice chancellor under Adolf Hitler. In 1945, von Papen was captured and tried with other Nazis as a war criminal. To expose the German plots completely, the Secret Service published all of Dr. Heinrich Albert's documents in the New York World newspaper. It made front-page history with banner headlines and illustrations of the incriminating credentials. When World War I had ended, George Sylvester Viereck summed up the briefcase affair in three succinct sentences. "The publication of the Albert papers was a catastrophe," he said. "A veritable nest of intrigue, conspiracy, and propaganda reposed placidly in the portfolio. Its loss was like the loss of the Marne." Walter S. Bowen and Harry Edward Neal, The United States Secret Service, 1960. In 1907, George Sylvester Viereck wrote The House of the Vampire, an early novella classic in its genre. His son, Peter Viereck, was a historian, political writer, and poet. Peter Viereck both rejected and was shaped by the ideologies of his father. George Sylvester Viereck collaborated with the American novelist Paul Eldridge on a trilogy of outlandish fantasy novels from 1928 to 1932, My First 2,000 Years, The Autobiography of the Wandering Jew, Salome, The Wandering Jewess and The Invincible Adam. Sigmund Freud once asked George Sylvester Viereck to help out on the subject matter of psychoanalysis. "My First 2,000 Years is a daydream analysis of a Lucifer persona while under hypnosis reporting his life story as he imagines it. The name Hazar is derived from the Turkish kazmak meaning to wander. The wandering Jew is a figure whose legend began to spread in Europe in the 13th century. My First 2,000 Years sketches a matching abstract between Adolf Hitler and Aleister Crowley, and flaunts an occult black magic credo. Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith." Rolling Stones, Sympathy for the Devil, 1968. "Imagine, a man named Cardophilus taunts Jesus on the way to the crucifixion, telling Jesus to hurry up. Jesus turns to the man and says, 'I shall go but you shall tarry until I return.' 30-year-old Cardophilus ceases to age. The good, Cardophilus meets many historical figures through the centuries, Apollonius, Mohammed, Attila, Leonardo da Vinci, Spinoza, Pope Alexander VI, a Borgia, Peter the Great, Martin Luther, and many, many more. He participates in and influences various fulcrums of history. He grapples with loneliness and ennui. He creates an immortal companion named Coda Cocora. He pursues a 2,000-year courtship of another immortal named Salome, yes, the Salome from the Bible, somewhat reimagined. It's a fun adventure which also lightly explores the downsides of living forever. The bad, this is definitely a man's fantasy, and not today's male but rather a man from a century ago. The author was born 1884. Cartaphilus travels to China where he masters the secret of unendurable pleasure indefinitely prolonged. Cliché, anyone. He travels to Baghdad after being rebuffed by Salome, and he drowns his sorrow by purchasing a palace and filling it with his own harem. Some of the attitudes of a century ago are, by today's standards, obvious belittlement and mistreatment of women. Kevin's reviews, My First 2000 Years, Goodreads. The leading role of Virek's excited psychoanalysis is Isaac Laquidem, a wealthy traveler from afar who sought refuge in a Greek monastery. He looks very much like Aleister Crowley trying to be Oscar Wilde in a velvet smoking jacket, a tall young man, evidently a gentleman of leisure, with black hair neatly parted and large melancholy eyes, seated himself at the table. His slant is more Eastern than European. In certain moments, in certain moods, he was positively Assyrian. The secrets of Egypt seemed to slumber in his long lashes. Laquidem then brings in his valet, Kota Kokura, bearing Russian cigarettes wrapped in silk, with imperial initials, a brand manufactured especially for the Tsar, emitting poppied smoke. Kota Kokura is very useful to me, he remarked nonchalantly. I picked him up in the East some years ago. Kota Kokura, a primitive, brutal animal type of man utterly devoted to his master, is the only living person in the world who shares the secret of Laquidem's true identity. The valet reminds us of the Führer's chauffeur, Pistol Schreck, the Bavarian body double chum Julian, who happened to be the wickedest person's masked SS gunman, from the earliest days of their comradeship. He was a yellow caricature of his master. Isaac Laquidem agrees with a few scientists to be hypnotized using a procedure like regression therapy, stirring memories of past lives or incarnations. His breath came heavily like that of a sleeper, his pulse beat against the wrist with subdued regularity. Before long, we take in that his solitary wish is to outstrip Salome, in a ritual of erotic magic involving Lucifer and Lilith. Here is the penance of a self-styled empty dogma. By releasing the beast we discover the god, is the illicit theme. It confuses healthy charm with dirty depravity of the deathless worm. What a curious notion this, to sleep with a dead man, and gather the worms of the corpse. Not so curious, Cartaphilus. A little disgusting, no doubt, but quite rational. Is not the soul supposed to lodge within the body? Such seems to be the essence of most creeds. Man attempts to preserve the soul. Undoubtedly he even preserves the ashes of the dead. There is more life in the worms than in the ashes that he guards with such care. Their writhing persuades the savage mind that the soul is a living reality. It continues to live in the worm. Man, Cartaphilus, is always logical. Whatever he does, proceeds from reason. The customs of your people, while nasty, are logical. She laughed ironically. George Sylvester Virek and Paul Eldridge, My First 2000 Years, The Autobiography of the Wandering Jew, 1928. A newfangled Nazi religion based on reverence to ancestral human hell myth. Or the magical side of what psychoanalyst Walter C. Langer reported without parable, My perversion is a parasite that sucks my lifeblood. Virek teases. The line between torture and pleasure is finer than the wing of a butterfly. But Langer rings a bell warning of hybrid infectious diseases. See, Ben Thomas, Meet the Parasites That Control Human Brains, Discover, October 29, 2015. The Metamorphosis, 1915, is a novella by Franz Kafka, cited as one of the leading works of fiction of the 20th century. The story kicks off with a traveling salesman, Gregor Samsa, waking up to discover himself malformed, metamorphosed, into a huge, ugly insect-like creature. His family is at first surprised by Gregor's transformation. His mother wants to enter his room. But her horror and loathing of Gregor's insect shape collide with her motherly inclination and kindness. Before I handled it, I'd been skeptical of the psychological impact this lampshade is supposed to have had on people. Its last owner was troubled by dreams so grotesque that he felt compelled to get it out of his house. The American author Mark Jacobson acquired the lamp in 2006. We have driven for a couple of hours from his home in Brooklyn, across two state lines, to the place where it's kept, safely enclosed in its box, at a location he prefers not to publicize, given the interest, not all of it healthy, that has been generated since his book The Lampshade, a Holocaust detective story was published in 2010. Witness accounts of such lampshades being discovered at Nazi concentration camps are so common that I'd never questioned the idea that these gruesome ornaments existed. Ilse Kuk, wife of the commandant at Buchenwald, was supposedly so partial to such accessories that she was nicknamed the Lady of the Lampshade. The Holocaust Museum at Auschwitz houses 2 tons of human hair, used by high-ranking Nazis to stuff cushions. The problem for the many who have described seeing lampshades made from people, sources include Allied troops, reporters, intelligence officers, and former camp detainees, is that no lampshade fashioned from human skin, of any provenance, has survived as potential support for their testimony. Until now. The report came back on April 20, 2007, Jacobson says. It found a 100% probability that the profile was human. Robert Chalmers, The Lampshade That Drives Its Owners Mad, Strange Truth Behind 20th Century's Most Disturbing Object, The Independent, October 31, 2010. On the day before Halloween, October 30, 1938, Orson Welles' electrifying War of the Worlds broadcast took place, in which the Mercury Theater on the air enacted a Martian invasion of Earth. Upwards of 1 million people were convinced, if only briefly, that the United States was being laid waste by alien invaders. The panic inspired by Welles made War of the Worlds perhaps the most notorious event in American broadcast history. That's the story you already know. It's the narrative widely reprinted in academic textbooks and popular histories. With actors dramatizing the reaction of frightened audience members, based on contemporaneous letters, a new documentary, part of PBS's American Experience series, reinforces the notion that naive Americans were terrorized by their radios back in 1938. The United States experienced a kind of mass hysteria that we've never seen before. There's only one problem: the supposed panic was so tiny as to be practically immeasurable on the night of the broadcast. Despite repeated assertions to the contrary in the PBS and NPR programs, almost nobody was fooled by Welles' broadcast. Jefferson Pooley and Michael Ciccolo, The Myth of the War of the Worlds Panic, Orson Welles' infamous 1938 radio program did not touch off nationwide hysteria. Why does the legend persist? Slate, October 28, 2013. On the day before Halloween, 1938, Ilse Kuk counted grisly lampshades and listened to her overseas radio. A program was performed so it would sound like news broadcasts. Somewhere in Nazi Europe, a civil worker sat at a machine to stitch fabrics together with thread. A great tapestry mission had begun with a supple new fabric, called the carpet. Civil workers didn't heed what the carpet was made of, a bit of cloth-like material that writhed like wet leather in ribbon-shaped bulks 20 feet long. Somewhere in Nazi Europe, civil workers fastened and attached fabrics using stitches with a needle and thread. On the day before Halloween, the Lady of the Lampshade shared an active Germanic belief in sympathetic magic that a man can change himself into a werewolf by donning a girdle belt. The heretical woman would stitch souls into the serpent girdle. Girdles were used for religious purposes in the Greek and Roman liturgy, and Anastasius mentions in the 9th CENT Murinula, or jeweled girdles in the shape of lampreys or eels. The girdle of Finan or St. John by an Irish monk may be a Celtic version of the Abraxas serpent girdle. The girdle of the serpent is my girdle, the serpent is about me that men may not wound me, that women may not destroy me. James Hastings, The Encyclopedia of Religion, Part 11. On the day before Halloween, a show put out a number of explanations that it was all a radio play, but if members of the audience missed a brief explanation at the beginning, the next one didn't arrive until 40 minutes into the program. Good heavens, "Something's wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake," the radio announcer said, in an appropriately dramatic tone of voice. "Now it's another one, and another. They look like tentacles to me. The torso of Athene has a gorgonigus fastened round the waist. Athena was depicted with a serpent girdle over a diploidian in the early period. Ares, god of war, wears a serpent girdle. This girdle, a kind of snake made of fabric, leather, or metal, is a symbol for sexual power. On the little Minoan snake goddess, two of the three snakes she wears actually form the girdle that goes round her hips." L.W. Wilde. Somewhere in Nazi Europe, a civil worker stitched cloth, serpent skins and furs, but did not fret if the vexing textile of the carpet was fraudulent ectoplasm. On the day before Halloween, people packed the roads, hid in cellars, loaded guns, even wrapped their heads in wet towels as protection from Martian poison gas, in an attempt to defend themselves against aliens, oblivious to the fact that they were acting out the role of the panic-stricken public that actually belonged in a radio play. In a prescient column, in the New York Tribune, Dorothy Thompson foresaw that the broadcast revealed the way politicians could use the power of mass communications to create theatrical illusions, to manipulate the public. All unwittingly, Mr. Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater of the Air have made one of the most fascinating and important demonstrations of all time, she wrote. They have proved that a few effective voices, accompanied by sound effects, can convince masses of people of a totally unreasonable, completely fantastic proposition as to create a nationwide panic. They have demonstrated more potently than any argument, demonstrated beyond a question of a doubt, the appalling dangers and enormous effectiveness of popular and theatrical demagoguery. Hitler managed to scare all of Europe to its knees a month ago, but he at least had an army and an air force to back up his shrieking words. But Mr. Welles scared thousands into demoralization with nothing at all. Ken Sinesh, War of the Worlds, Orson Welles, and the Invasion from Mars, Transparency, 1996-2013. Somewhere in Europe, a mind-reading tentacle of V2 outer space ectoplasm took on the wireframe shape of a human torso, the homunculus. The beast is in the girdle and can climb up stairwells and go into rooms unseen. On the day before Halloween, a Hydra hermaphrodita alien invasion hoax was reported on the overseas radio. This trophy from the Python 1, this robe, in which the deed was done, a serpent girdled round he wore, the tail within the mouth, before, his vest, for day and night, was pied, a bending sickle armed his side, Thomas Parnell 1679-1718, an allegory on man. Carl Jung, 1909. While Freud was going on in this way, I had a curious sensation. It was as if my diaphragm were made of iron and was becoming red-hot, a glowing vault. And at that moment there was such a loud report in the bookcase, which stood right next to us, that we both started up in alarm, fearing the thing was going to topple over on us. I said to Freud, there is an example of a so-called catalytic exteriorization phenomenon. Oh come, he exclaimed. That is sheer bosh. It is not, I replied. You are mistaken, Herr Professor. And to prove my point, I now predict that there will be another loud report. Sure enough, no sooner had I said the words than the same detonation went off in the bookcase. To this day I do not know what gave me the certainty. Len Fisher, Ph.D., Jung's explosive visit to Freud, did Jung cause Freud's bookcase to explode by mental force? Psychology Today, September 20, 2011.